Kevin Baker, welcome back to the Bookshelf Conversations.
And thanks for having me back, Ron. Good to see you.
So this is a bit of a departure because we are going to talk about a book that's older than my daughter. So what the first thing I want to ask you is, what do you think of when I hold up this picture of you as the author of the book? Sometimes You See It Coming, a novel by Kevin Baker, which was first released in 1993. Where has the time gone?
First sold it in 1991. They like to publish baseball books in the spring though, so we waited till then. But yeah, first book I ever sold.
Now, let me ask you, one of the things I was thinking of is the comparison, the relative freedom of writing fiction, where everything is up to you, versus the, I hate to use this word, but for lack of a better word, tyranny of writing nonfiction, where you're kind of limited by hopefully facts.
I do try to be limited by facts. I fiction does allow you to take more risks, more liberties. I write a lot of historical fiction, as it has turned out since then. That's interesting to me because that directly kind of conflicts with a lot of the history I write, in the sense of, like, people will often ask me, is it is this improving on history or not? And I don't think you can really improve on a great history. What I think good historical fiction is doing is maybe honing a story or speculating on a story in a way that I don't feel anyone should be doing in history, although a lot of the old borders are down. I remember Edmund Morris writing that book about Reagan, in which he injected himself as a character and all that. I don't find that legitimate. Write a novel if that's what you want to do. So I think novels do give you that liberty. This book certainly gave me that liberty. But it's been very interesting writing history of the sport, often since then, and getting that perspective. In some ways, it's easier to deal with something that's restricted by the facts, but all fiction is based on actual things that happened, I would think, all good fiction at least, as in this book, which was inspired by real events in the lives of Roberto Clemente and Ty Cobb. So
I was going
that's
over that a little bit
stuff, yeah.
just before we spoke, and I made some notes, and there are some parallels, if you will, between your novel and actual events. And I didn't want to give too much away by even though it's 30 some odd years later. spoiler alert. But yes, Clemente and Ty Cobb, and I think I also recognized a little Tony Kubek in there, and a little Billy Martin in there, maybe.
And as writing the book went on, I often start with a big outline and then I kind of, end up getting away from that. But as the book went on, I ended up making it pretty much kind of a compilation of all these sort of great moments and great characters in baseball because I couldn't really improve upon them. The manager's based somewhat on Billy Martin. The owner is based on that guy who used to own the Mets, run the Mets. What's his name? Sold he sold off Seaver and everybody during the
Oh, Grant, Don Grant.
M. Donald
M.
Grant.
Donald
That's right.
Grant.
The pretentious first initial for his, he sold off Seaver and all that. He's based somewhat on that. And there are various plays in there that are based on real plays that happen throughout big, great moments in baseball. And that's what I mean in a way by can't, being unable to improve on it. Baseball has such natural drama and has given us such So many amazing moments through its history that it'd be hard to make up one that that's brand new.
One of the things I noticed in a lot of baseball novels, and maybe you can address why this is so, there frequently seems to be a member of the press in there, a sports writer. Some are good, some are not so good, like Max Mercy in The Natural is not good. But why is that such a staple of baseball novels?
Yeah, mine is more Barry Busby, this guy who was based sort of on the late Dick Young. And Dick Young was really this transformational sports writer. But in his later years, he'd become this just ridiculous reactionary and kind of tool of the owners who was always dissing players. I guess the idea is first, writers are more natural writing about writers, are more at ease writing about writers. Second is somebody to frame the story and to have an outside voice. A lot of my novels have different points of view, almost all of them. I sort of I call it the urban voice. It's this idea of the story coming from all these different places. So it was natural in that sense to get this character in there, the sports writer. And it's interesting the way sports writing has changed over the years. Initially, to my surprise, when I was writing the New York game, the actual history of New York baseball, I was surprised to learn that sports writers did not generally go into the clubhouses in baseball, in part because a lot of them were writing for afternoon papers, so they had a very strict deadline. In part because they spent a lot of time with the players anyway. For instance, when all the travel was done by Pullman cars, you could be with these players on a 27-hour Pullman trip from New York to St. Louis, say. But that changed with people like Young after World War II, who were in the clubhouse, who were interviewing the players, who were confronting them about certain things. And you had the Chipmunks, this group of young writers who were kind of breaking all the old rules and confronting these players and asking them hard questions. And that got more and more the case. And then you had people like Dick Young, who's basically like by the end was reciting, was repeating clubhouse gossip, was repeating stories the owners wanted out about the players. But now, sadly, a lot of that seems to have faded. Sports writing, I think, has really been hurt by the highlight show. The daily highlight show, ESPN and other local channels. It's more and more difficult, I think, to write something of the moment and that's really breezy and terrific and hits the spot. I mean, Dick Young, for all his faults, gave us one of the most famous leads of all time with after Don Larsen's perfect game, when filling in for another writer who was just blocked on it, wrote the imperfect man pitches perfect game. So that was the sort of thing you could do and make these sort of instant classics. And then there were people like Roger Angel, who was writing in a monthly basis for the New Yorker, and just the beauty of his prose and the beauty of his insights brought that up to another level, maybe the highest level sports writing has ever been at. But after that, it's very difficult to be, I think, today to be a sports writer, and that's how I started off, is writing schoolboy sports. I think it's very difficult to go in there and come up with some great observation and get it out to a place where anybody is really looking and anybody's really caring as newspapers continue to crater. So a hard time for that profession.
That's what I notice, especially in recent years. The highlight show, the preponderance of more bloggers. I mean, the Times cut its sports section. I can't find out what the Mets did last night in the regular sports section anymore. I don't read the other New York papers, so I don't know what their coverage or lack of coverage is about. But you mentioned that you based some of your events in the book on real life. What is there some sort of rule? Because I notice in many cases, people make up names for teams and leagues, but you use actual. Is there a rule for that?
Not really. It's funny. When I was a kid, that was much more the preferred thing. I guess everybody was more afraid about being sued. So I remember reading all this baseball fiction about, the New York Mammoths or the New York Titans or whatever, and things like that. And that's fun, but I just figured what the heck, I'd go with it. Of course, it's pretty unlikely that my hero is a repeat batting champion in the old Shea Stadium, where it would have been very hard for anyone to be a batting champ. But I think there are no rules in that sense anymore. I don't think anyone's going to sue you. I suppose, I mean, some of these people were fairly close to actual individuals. I suppose if somebody were going to sue you, they might, at if you get to a certain point of but people write such awful things about everyone on the internet now that I can't imagine anybody would be that upset by a novel.
The two main characters, to my mind, in your book are Barr, who is the
John
star.
Barr, yeah.
Is he based on anyone?
He's just sort of a compilation of people. I think if I had to write the book again, I would have actually tried to make it about Ty Cobb. But there was I think well that novel Hoopla is partly about Cobb as it is, and that was, he did a fine job with that. I'm blanking on the name, but
Harry Stein.
Harry Stein. So if I but if I were going to do it again, I put it closer to reality and make it a player from the past, such as Cobb, who had this very traumatic thing happen in his life. And so it would have been interesting. But Cobb's also a very unpleasant individual, and not somebody who's possible in the modern day, really. An out and out racist, somebody who was really looking for a fight every time he set foot on a ball field. So I had to sort of translate his dedication into a more current athlete, to somebody who's maybe more like Rogers Hornsby with his kind of single-minded approach to the game, but still ultimately more pleasant than Hornsby, more likable.
And the other player was the old swizzle head.
Yes,
Is he based on when I read some of his stuff, I thought a bit about Mickey Rivers.
Exactly. That's what inspired him. And as first novels will go, the book is just probably overly packed with colorful names and nicknames.
Yes.
But with Rivers, it was the old Gozzlehead was what they used to call him. And he was an amazing character. The real life stories about him are incredible. For instance, at one point at Yankee Stadium, his wife caught up to him about his about a mistress of his, and came to the parking lot and rammed one of his cars into the car he had parked there, to the point where both were pretty unusable. And apparently he just sat in front of his locker, looking like he was in despair. But he went out that day and got like four hits.
There
And
you
that
go.
was Mickey Rivers to a T. He had some great actual saying. I couldn't make this up, but it's that I don't worry about the things I can do something about because I can do something about them. And I don't worry about the things I can't do anything about because I can't do anything about them. And
That's one of my favorites.
that is such a perfect Zen moment there.
Well, one of the other things I noticed in the book that I don't know if you could do it today, some of the racial language,
Yes,
shall we
yeah.
say,
Oh, yeah.
what was it? Was it uncomfortable for you to include that? And
Well,
again, do you think you could do that today?
it was blunt, and ball players tend to be blunt. I don't know if I could do that. I almost certainly couldn't do that today. And that strikes me as a level of censorship, of political correctness that I think is a little out of control. I mean, it doesn't feel good writing some of that stuff. It's not good to have in our culture, but it's there. And if you can't even depict bad people saying bad things, then where do you go?
Interesting.
How do you show villains? Are they all supposed to talk nicely? How I don't know how would you depict Nazis, say, during the Holocaust, doing hideous things? Are they also supposed to be chatting politely? I think it destroys that sort of authenticity, or any sort of authenticity, in too many instances. But this seems to be just something we're struggling with right now in this in our country, and we have many greater struggles that are much more important to work through. But yeah, I certainly would not be able to use some of those words. I would not be able to put in some of the sex, use some of these scenes. It's much more restricted today. And I was glad I was able to write a couple novels in that time before the hammer came down.
Now, you mentioned if you could do it again. I'm
Yeah.
wondering how many versions, edits did you have to go through until you were satisfied with this?
Oh, quite a few. I mean, I started not with this book, but with another one. I started writing fiction, started writing a novel in college, and I figured I would finish this and sell it before I graduated. Well, 15 years later, I finally sold. I finally sold. Sometimes you see it coming here in the paperback edition from Harvard.
Could you hold it up again, please?
Let me share. Finally sold it 15 years later. I had said before I was going to go to law school if I hadn't sold anything by 30. I didn't. Kept writing, kept working. So the one thing of starting that early taught me was the discipline of writing. I determined to do 5 pages every day, so I had to sit down and do that until it was done. And that was what a huge amount of writing is. But I had to do a lot of living. I had to find a better story. This story sort of evolved actually out of something I originally read in Baseball Guide about Roberto Clemente being sort of kidnapped for a night by these lunatics, and it changed a lot from that. But then there's the Ty Cobb story, so I put these things together and just started writing about baseball. And yeah, I went through several different levels, several different versions, but I finally got it to the point where someone, Dick Merrick at Crown, was willing to take it on, and came into his office, and he said, "You really need to cut about a third of it and change the ending, and you're really more an anecdotalist right now than a novelist." So I was just gobsmacked. It's like, great. Why'd you buy the thing? But I did that. Work done. It was good working with him. It sold it. I mean, I had already sold. Got it out there. It sold something, and people were very kind to it. And on I went.
Well, when you say he wanted you to change the ending, what was your original ending?
I'm not really sure even what I had with the original anymore. It's been a long
Okay, it's been a
time,
while, yeah.
but been several different versions. But I think it was something more cruel and sad. I tend to that in my fiction. That probably moved away from that more as I've gotten older. The world is cruel enough and sad enough without making the endings, all endings, as cruel as you can. It's good to have some hope in there, which I hope is in here.
I tell that to my wife sometimes when she wants to watch a certain TV show about
Yes.
a dystopian future. I say, things are bad enough. I want to be entertained a little bit. I don't want to see what's coming.
I know. I'm so tired of the dystopian future. We've lived through the age of the dystopian future, thanks to the threat of nuclear war and everything else. And now I want to see maybe the hopeful future, if that's possible.
Now, the reason I asked you to hold up the book before is I noticed that book seems to have photographs in it, whereas the original hardcover version is a drawing, painting, what you will. Do you have any say in the cover of the book? Are you consulted on that?
I had what they call cover consultation, and not cover approval. So they'd show it to me beforehand and say, "What do you think?" And if they liked it, then it was going through. But I did like it. I liked very much the kind of, I guess it's really a painting they did on the first one. And you can see it's hard to see, but the eyes on John Barr there, who are kind of looking backwards a little, so he's sort of looking out toward the viewer a little. So it's a nice quasi mysterious cover. I was thinking of calling it, well, they wanted to call it Hardball first. Which my wife came up with this title. Sometimes you see it coming, which I think stands out a lot more. People
Oh,
have
sure.
trouble getting it right at times, but it Hardball is kind of generic. It became a TV political commentary show. I think it would have been lost with that title. Sometimes you see it coming, I think stands out more.
He's wearing number 13. Superstitions mean they are in baseball. Does that have any significance?
Just that he's willing to wear that. It's he feels he's kind of under a curse. With Warren Spahn, I think, was 13. A-Rod was 13, although he always managed to make enough trouble for himself without bringing any bad luck in on it. So yeah, superstitions are huge in baseball. It's one of the fun parts to the game. Everything from rally caps to not stepping on the foul lines when you go on and off the field. All the little rituals players are into are wonderful. It's a game that plays with your head, I think, more than most. There's an element of the mental, of course, in all sports, but I think in baseball it's particularly easy to slip into a slump for no real discernible reason. Everything is on such an edge that it's just a little change, even if unintentional, can really throw you off. And I think that's maybe why baseball players are more superstitious than others.
Let's move on to your award-winning book. Congratulations,
Oh, well, thank you.
the New York Game, which I was delighted to find out in our last conversation has a volume two coming.
It's the game. The first one here ends in 1945, which is, it turns out, is really is a great turning point. I had written this insanely overlarge manuscript in the first, going straight from the 1820s to today, or today now a few years ago when I finally turned this in. And the good people at Knopf, John Freeman, my editor, and Andrew Miller and all were very nice to me. And just looked at this huge pile for a bit and said, okay, we'll cut it in half. So they did. And this is the first half. 45 seemed like a good place. It's a history of both the game and the city. And it seemed like a good place to cut because 45, Branch Rickey signs Jackie Robinson. And he's going to finally break the color line in baseball after way, way too long a time. At the same time, the city, New York, has emerged from world. It's really the only great city unbowed and unbloodied during World War II, a great world city. It's emerged from that. This is sort of the golden age of New York coming up, but there are a lot of problems in the city or lurking in the city, a lot of unresolved things that are going to have to be resolved and are going to really change the city utterly. So that struck me as a good place for that. And there's a lot more great baseball. So it's done. It has to be edited. I have to fill in through the fifth inning fiasco of last year's World Series, and possibly the Juan Soto age in Flushing. So as a Yankees fan, it's very sad to see Juan go to the Mets, but as the author of this book, I think it's a great possible conclusion, the real sort of turning point here, where the Mets, after 30 plus years, it's got almost been 40 years since they last won anything, returned to being New York's team. And I think that's what's possibly in the offing. The Mets have the billionaire now who's willing to spend, and as opposed to the kind of nepo babies who run every other New York sports team, it seems. So I think this is their age coming up, and it will be interesting to end on that note, and on the note too of how Queens has been transformed from being this borough that was the home of Archie Bunker, to being an incredibly diverse, interesting, fun place. I really think it's the pulse of New York right now. It reminds me a lot of Manhattan in the 70s without the crime and the dysfunction. So I think this is sort of the next shift coming up, and I think that'll be great to see, especially for Mets fans.
Are you working on anything else, or are you concentrating on the New York book?
Yeah, I'm also working on a on another overdue book. I am trying to condense it in because I just can't give this like hugely long book in to anyone again and burden them with that. Working on a history, a political cultural history of the United States between the World Wars,
Wow.
so 1919 to 1941, incredible period, very hard period, very tough period, but one in which we really moved to the forefront in the world in all sorts of things, everything from pop culture to military might, when American architecture and music kind of took over, when American writing and painting was taken seriously for the first time, and where we made these political choices, going from this country coming out of World War I that was a hot mess. It was really troubled. You had 80 lynchings a year. You had a higher percentage of workers on strike in 1919 than you would ever have before since. All the strikes were crushed, and the unions were generally crushed with them. You had this country which really just seemed in turmoil and seemed to be regressing. And we figured that out and didn't solve everything, but people fought back and organized and changed things and ended up making a ended up stopping world fascism. So I it's become more and more, I think, these days, I hope, a book of hope, also a book of how we did this before and how we might do this again despite what seemed to be all the odds.
Something that occurs to me when I talk to writers like you who are so prolific, it strikes me a little like starting exercise. You feel you have to do it. It's painful getting back to it, and you want to stop. Do you ever feel like writing gets to be a burden? But you have to keep on through it.
I feel I have writer's block every single day. I say every time when I sit down at the keyboard, I feel I have writer's block. And what helps is to go over the previous day's writing. Or previous, and then I get into it, and then I start to go, and that feels good at some point, and then I start thinking every single thing I'm writing is absolutely golden prose, and then it's time to stop. because it's not, it's not that good. So, but yeah, I feel I have to work through it all the time. But and it's something that does not get easier in the sense that the more you do it, the more you learn how difficult it is and how much better it should be or could be. So that's something to you have to take into account. But I'm very lucky to have been able to make my living doing this for years now, decades, and it was the life I wanted. It was the life I was able to pursue, and that's been just I count my blessings about that. So
And
it's yeah, I'm sorry.
no.
I'm just going to say, it's funny with right, you're talking about that. Like I was, speaking of Roger Angel, I did a book with an As Told To book with Reggie Jackson, Becoming Mr. October, and in interviewing him, trying to get him to open up some, I read a few passages from Roger Angel about his October performances to him in 77 and 78. And he listened raptly and nodded and said, "Oh, you see, Kevin, just write something like that, and and then I'll paint like Rembrandt and I'll, yeah, I'll do all this." It's easier said than done. But the greats do inspire us.
Well, and you certainly have become one of the greats. We've been talking again with Kevin
Thank you.
Baker, author of the 1993 novel, Sometimes You See It Coming, and looking forward to talking with you again when the new book comes out.
I look forward to that too, Ron. Thanks so much for having me on.